You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the first attempt by a Republican-led state to restrict drag shows has been blocked by a judge. With drag artists under attack, does the First Amendment protect their right to perform? Find out more today at 6 on 1A+. Now, former President Donald Trump was arraigned in a New York courtroom today on 34 felony charges of falsifying business records. The charges stem from Trump's alleged cover-up of a hush money payment to an adult film actress in 2016. He entered a plea of not guilty on all counts. It's the first time a former U.S. president has faced criminal charges. Police presence was heavy in and around the courtroom. Outside, a few hundred protesters, including earlier in the day, Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene demonstrated in support of Trump, along with some counter-protesters. We're talking about what we learned today, what to expect next, and some of the political reaction. And you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the legal aspects, maybe the nuances of this case, how things work in these charges against the former president? How are you feeling about a former president being charged with these crimes? If you voted for Donald Trump in the past, does this case sway your feelings about voting for him again, one way or the other? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's author of the book Politainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
I understand you've had a chance to read through the complaints since they were released earlier today. What did you learn there?
What I learned was something quite interesting here is that keep in mind that she's not being charged with making a hush money payout. Right. What he's being charged with here is 34 counts under New York state law where it's basically business fraud. And what the legal argument is that when he made the payments to Stormy Daniels and another person, what he did was to try to conceal those payments through the Trump Organization by falsely listing them as payments for legal services or for other types of activities, but mostly legal services. So at the end of the day, what the Manhattan County DA is saying is that under New York state law, if you are committing a state crime, and the state crime here was illegally promoting a candidate for office. If you're doing something illegal, and then try to cover it up, we can charge you under New York state fraud laws for the fraud that occurred. And here, the reason why it's 34 counts is that Trump, through Michael Cohen, made multiple payments, not one check, but multiple payments and multiple false entries in business books in order to conceal that payment.
Now, I'm going to read from the counts here. Now, this is a phrase that appears in many of these counts,
right,
that the defendant, and I'm quoting here, with intent to defraud and intent to commit another crime and aid and conceal the commission thereof, made and caused a false entry in the business records of an enterprise. Now, this seems key to me, David. I'm not a law talking guy, but if it was without that intent to deceive and it's just a false entry, I believe that would be something you could charge as a misdemeanor. That other crime, that covering up another crime or intent to commit another crime is a big part of this and why it can be charged as a felony. Do I have this right?
Exactly. You have it correct here. I don't want to use the old phrase that sometimes it's not the deed, but it's the effort to conceal the deed, or not the crime, but the cover up, to use an old phrase here. That's exactly what's going on here, is that it was the cover up that is really the problem here. It was the effort to try to hide the fact that this underlying payment was being made to essentially to Stormy Daniels and so forth. That's really a big problem here. So that's that ratchets it from a misdemeanor to a felony. And just so people understand, under New York state law, a felony under New York state statute 175, it is punishable up to 4 years in prison. So we're now looking at 34 counts, each of which carry a maximum of 4 years in prison. Now, does that mean if he were convicted, it's going to be 4 times 34? Unlikely it would be that, but these are a lot of charges for felony fraud.
Now, this seems like a potential weakness in the case, David. For that just misdemeanor charge, it seems like fairly easy to prove if this isn't what, in fact, what former President Trump did, prove that he made false statements. But if it's to cover up a crime, and this is something that reporters asked the prosecutor here afterwards, he's not being prosecuted for those crimes that he's alleged to have covered up. So there's a chicken or egg thing. Do you see that as a potential line of attack from the former president's defense?
That is potential, and that's one of the things. It was my law students that we were talking to about this today as we were watching it and reading it through, is that you don't have to prove the primary crime, that is a federal violation or a state violation, New York State violation of election law, in order to be able to charge with the fraud here. That seems counterintuitively odd, but my understanding of New York State law, fraud law, and this is actually one of the statutes that I teach in one of my classes here, is that it's fairly commonplace to use this type of ratcheting up, even though you don't have to prove that the primary violation actually the person is guilty of. It seems very odd to me, but the courts have upheld that.
Talking to Dave Schultz from the law school at the University of Minnesota, looking at today's arraignment of former President Trump. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Connie is with us in Portage. Connie, hello. What do you think?
Well, I'm very excited. I've been waiting 6 years for somebody to make him accountable for something. And so I'm just hoping, but I'm sort of afraid that he's going to get away with it again. I don't know why. I don't know how he can escape 34 counts. I think he has to be, they have to charge him with something. But anyway, I'm very excited that they're finally doing something about him.
Connie, thanks a lot for the call. These are not, I think, slam dunk charges, David, if this goes to trial. I, for one, wouldn't put a lot of money on it going one way or the other. Connie is worried that the president wouldn't be convicted here.
That's a concern. Remember, we should always start with the presumption in our society of innocence until proven guilty. Donald Trump deserves the exact same presumption. We're going to have to see the actual evidence as it unfolds when the trial occurs. It's sounding like the trial might not be for about 9 months from now. But if I want to make Connie feel a little bit happier and try to stay neutral on this, if you go and download the statement of facts, and I believe it's paragraph 41 where it says, in talking about the underlying, you know, payoffs here, it says, ultimately, the other participants in the scheme admitted that the payoffs were unlawful. My students and I agree that in the statement of fact, paragraph 41 is incredibly critical, because here you now have, the admission of the underlying crime. So if you're worried about that linkage, there you have it there. On top of which, again, as I'm starting to look at some of the evidence as it's being unfolded here, again, this was not one check that was being cut. It was multiple checks over many months. And so, again, still not going to say that it's a slam dunk, because it's not, and not a problematic case. But as I'm reading it through and listening to Bragg this afternoon, as the prosecutor, it sounds like they have quite a bit of evidence at this point. It's obviously going to go up to a jury, and I think it's going to be interesting, especially if Donald Trump testifies. How's a jury going to view Donald Trump, Michael Cohen? I don't know if Stormy Daniels is going to testify. I think that becomes interesting in terms of who believes whom.
Thanks for that call. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I, like you, I'm listening intently to the evidence and everything that's presented. And myself, I support Trump. I think what he did was not illegal. And if I was serving on a jury, the way I see this is he paid his lawyer fees. And there's nothing illegal about paying your lawyer fees. Thank you.
Jeff, thanks for the call. David.
Yeah, I think it's a good observation. I think part of what this case is going to hinge upon is that, was he paying legitimate legal fees, or did he conceal another crime by describing this as legal fees? And that's what we're going to have to see the evidence as it unfolds. And unless that caller who just called in happens to be a New York, a Manhattan County resident, He won't be on the jury. I won't be on the jury, of course. It's going to be eventually what do the jurors sitting in this box, what evidence do they see and how they're going to weigh it. And I think that's critical. So I think the caller is absolutely correct that it's going to hinge upon what was this payment really for, and can we believe Trump or Cohen or whom can we believe, and what kind of documents are there? That's why we have trials.
Jeff, thanks for the call. We're talking to David Schultz, political scientist at Hamline University, law professor at the University of Minnesota, looking at the criminal charges facing former President Trump, his arraignment in court earlier today. You can join in with your reactions, your questions about how this all works at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with David Schultz from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota, looking at today's arraignment of former President Trump and the charges against him. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, before we go back to our callers, one of President Trump's legal team has said we're not going to do a plea for a lesser crime, but also hinted that they don't expect that this case will necessarily end up in trial. What are some of the other ways that this case could not end up going to trial? I guess moving to dismiss these charges and asking the judge to do that?
They could do that, yes. They could argue that as a matter of law, they could first say that the prosecutor doesn't have a case here and move very quickly at that point. And I expect them to do that. They could also maybe after they do some initial sharing of evidence, which they're going to require to do. Prosecutor is required under the Constitution to provide Trump with all the evidence that they're going to use. Maybe at that point, they make a motion for a dismissal of the case for summary judgment to have the case dismissed. So I think that's where they're aiming for at this point, is to say that we think there's an insufficiency of facts, or the law does not cover this situation, and therefore we're going to ask for a dismissal of all or some of the charges.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jed is with us in Lacouture. Jed, hi.
Bonjour.
What did you want to bring up, Jed?
Well, just seems like more of the same to me. And the sadness is that the same hasn't been working. So my gut feeling is that if something wasn't working then, it's not all of a sudden going to work now. And I just feel like there's got to be better ways for our time, energy, and resources. It's just really unfortunate because there's very real things happening to real people nowadays. And, you know, the payments were made in 16, the affair in 06, and here we are in 23. And so that's 17 years now. And it's just like,
I gotcha, Jed. Point taken. I think, David, Jed making the case that even if we ultimately agree that illegal things were done here, is this the best use of our prosecutorial and court resources to prosecute this particular alleged crime?
Well, that's a good question here. Now, we can sort of cut it in a couple of ways. One of them is to say that this is New York City. This is where, I think the prosecutor pointed out, it's the financial center of the United States, if not of the world, that if we don't take seriously financial fraud and bank fraud, or rather I say financial business fraud there, you know, what repercussions it have across the country? Because in some sense, the way we can describe it here, take Donald Trump's name off of this, this is just another business fraud case. And should we be prosecuting white collar crimes? I would say we probably should. Now, if you're coming back and saying that so much time has passed, well, the reason why they couldn't bring this case before is that when he was president, the interpretation is a sitting president can't be indicted. And maybe it just took them time to gather all this evidence to come to bear. But you still raise a good question here. With all the different things going on in the world, might there be a better use of prosecutorial resources in this? And I think it's a fair question, and people get to raise that in terms of saying, should they be going after more what? Murderers, drug dealers, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a legitimate criticism that could be looked at.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Allison is with us now in Waukesha. Allison, hi.
Hi. My thoughts on this are if this actually did go all the way to a trial, who in the world could they actually get to be on the jury if they're looking for, you know, an unbiased person? There's not one citizen in this entire country that doesn't have some sort of opinion one way or the other about Donald Trump.
Allison, thanks for the call. And yeah, in Manhattan, David, let's find somebody without strong prejudgments potentially of Donald Trump. How difficult a task might that be to fill that jury?
That could be difficult. I was going to say, not just in Manhattan, but across the United States, but certainly in Manhattan. Okay, I'm in Minnesota where, for example, about a couple of years ago, Derek Chauvin was on trial, you know, for the murder of George Floyd. And everybody said it's going to be impossible to find an impartial jury because of the pretrial coverage. And we managed to do it because what the standard is going to be is not that you've not heard about Donald Trump, but are you open to hearing the facts, open to hearing the law, and can you render an impartial judgment based on that? Not that you've heard about the facts, but can you render an impartial judgment here? So that's going to still be a difficult call here, but I was going to say, I forget what the number is. There's probably 4 or 5 million adults in Manhattan. It'll be tough, but I think they'll be able to find, you know, 12 to 15 people who will say that they can do that.
Thanks for the call, Allison. Larry is with us now in Dodgeville. Hi, Larry.
Yes, I was wondering, would there be any type of statute of limitations to these charges versus when some of the first payments were made, all the way up to the end of the last payments, and as far as a trial that were to start? Is there any type of time limit for that stuff?
Larry, thanks for the call. My understanding, David, in New York is the clock kind of stops on statute of limitations for someone who's living out of state for a while, say at the White House. Do you see statute of limitations coming up here?
I do not see statute of limitations coming up for exactly the reason that you pointed out, is that under New York state law, it's not until you basically come back to the state that the clock statute of limitations kicks in. And you're right. He was living in Washington, D.C. He was living in Florida. At some point, I can't remember when it was, he changed his official residence from Manhattan to Florida. So we don't face a problem there. And he's been indicted, there's no longer a statute of limitations issue because they brought the charges. And even if it takes a year or so to actually do the trial, we're no longer in danger of that issue.
Thanks for the call, Larry. Tony joins us now in Sturgeon Bay. Tony, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. If he is jailed, which we all don't believe he ever will be, would the Secret Service have to serve time with him in prison?
Tony, thanks for the call. Now, we saw already logistical issues, a lot of arrangements made for exactly that reason in Trump's court appearance today. Could you talk about the questions that a potential prison time for a former president might bring up, David?
Well, first off, it's funny you asked that because my students and I were talking about that today, too. The first answer is to say we don't know. The second answer would be probably, let's say he were convicted of a felony. Given the fact that he's a white-collar criminal, I doubt he's going to Sing Sing. I doubt he's going to Attica in New York. It will be probably one of the other facilities that deal with white-collar criminals, and there'll be ample security there to keep him safe. At least we presume there will be. So I don't think we're going to see the Secret Service at the prison with him.
Tony, thanks for the call. Now, obviously, that's a lot of time between here and something like that even being a possibility, David. What happens next? This isn't going to be over in the next week or two, most likely.
Absolutely correct. So we had the arraignment today in which it was just a plea of guilty or not guilty, not guilty. They were not allowed, that is the Trump attorneys, to be able to file any motions. Look to see a couple of things happening. The first thing will be meeting with the prosecution to lay out a schedule. That schedule will be for when motions have to be filed, such as dismissal of the case. It'll be for when the prosecution has to turn over evidence. It will be about all the pretrial matters and pretrial hearings that will occur. So that's going to start to unfold over the next few weeks. Again, I heard something at some point during the course of the day, maybe you heard the same thing that I did, that the anticipation is the trial probably would not be for about a year. And that's about average that what we would say for most trials trials in the United States is that from time of arraignment to an actual trial, it could take 6, 9 months or a year. And if we do some calendar here now, that would put us, let's say it's a year, around April, March or April of 2024. That's in the middle of the primary season. And I was going to ask here, I'm guessing that the presidential primary in Wisconsin next year is probably somewhere around, what, April or something like that.
I haven't looked at the calendar. David, as we wrap up, I mean, the payments, as we learned from the Michael Cohen conviction, were made so that Stormy Daniels didn't tell her, make her allegations in the run-up to a presidential election. We could end up with Stormy Daniels under oath in a public court hearing in the middle of the primaries, talking about that very thing. Your thoughts on that in our last minute?
No, you're absolutely correct. I mean, she could be testifying regarding, well, basically, potentially an extramarital affair that she had with Donald Trump about the payouts. And this is going to be the issue when they have a trial. Let's say Donald Trump does testify. You have Trump testifying, say, no, I didn't do this. Stormy Daniels is going to say yes. Michael Cohen, who is Donald Trump's attorney, is going to say something else. As a jury, how do you weigh all these competing he said, she says, et cetera, to make a decision? That is going to be a tough job, I think, for a jury.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you to the audience.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He talked to us about what we learned today about the charges against former President Donald Trump and what we can expect next in the case. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, AR-15-style firearms boomed in sales and popularity in recent years, and they became a weapon of choice in many high-profile mass shootings. We'll look at an in-depth investigation into the rise of the new breed of firearms. And we'll find out what today's state Supreme Court election outcome means for high-profile issues and cases here in Wisconsin. Our own Sean Johnson will join us. And as always, you can join in with your reactions to whatever ends up happening. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk with a philosophy and law expert about what we owe to animals and ways we can reframe our relationship with the animal world. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Humans as a species have used other animals for food, clothing, companionship, and more for a long, long time. And more recently, humans have caused more and more generalized harm to animals. Things like air pollution affecting birds, habitat destruction limiting the range of migratory animals, plastic in the ocean getting in the stomachs of whales. Our next guest says we have a large and in many ways growing debt to pay these animals. She says we can start by getting the law to work more in their favor to protect their ability to flourish. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What concerns do you have about animal well-being? Is there a change you'd like to see made in our legal system, in our world, in our attitude toward animals? What is it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Martha Nussbaum is the Ernst Freund Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics in the Law and Philosophy Department at the University of Chicago. She's the author of many books on philosophy, economic development, and more. Her newest book is called Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. Martha, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on. I'm really looking forward to this.
You've written so many books over the years about philosophy and ethics as it applies to humans. What led you into considering justice for animals?
Well, I've been thinking about that for quite a long time. But even more because my daughter became a lawyer for animal rights, and she was working for an NGO called Friends of Animals. And then in 2019, she died very tragically. So that made me think a lot more about writing a book on this topic. In fact, even when she was ill, I was already writing the book, and she knew about it, and we had co-authored some articles together. But it was really my daughter that opened my eyes to the huge problems of animals when they're outside our national control. Whales were her particular passion. And so I learned a lot from her, and then I took it from there and studied many other kinds of animals. And, you know, there's so much good science about animals. And we know so much about the wonderful things they are capable of if they can have a chance to flourish. So that is really what started me writing this book.
I want to talk about that idea of animal flourishing. A key concept to your book is something called the capability approach. Again, this is something that you've talked about when it comes to people. What do we mean about the capability approach when it comes to recognizing the well-being, the flourishing of non-human animals?
Okay, first of all, what it means is we don't think that an animal is worth protecting only because it's like us. It's each form of life has its own complexity and its own activities. And so the capabilities approach says, look at each form of life, and don't you think that each animal should have a chance to live a characteristic life of that species without human thwarting? But then it's also not focused narrowly on just one thing. I think utilitarians like Peter Singer have done a lot of good for animals by focusing on pain. But pain is not the only thing that's important in animal life. If we could just end all the pain that we cause to animals, that would be huge progress. But many zoos do not inflict pain on animals. And if the animal is born in a zoo, it really doesn't know what a real life for an elephant or for a, you know, another large animal would actually be like. So animals need company, and company that's usually very complicated. Elephants need a large herd that couldn't possibly be in a zoo. Whales need pods, and dolphins too, of a large number of creatures. And so this leads me to a critique of zoos, among other things. But anyway, an animal needs lots of things. It needs room to move around in. It needs care and attention. And it depends on the kind of animal it is. What it needs, it varies with the kind. So that's what the capabilities approach says. Capabilities are not inside abilities. They are spaces for choice. They're opportunities to choose to live a life of the kind of creature you are. And so we should be creating those spaces in our world where a whale could live a whale life without getting choked by plastic and dinned in its ears by sonar, where elephants could wander and eat and wander across large tracts of land without dangers of poaching and without habitat destruction. And so on, for every kind of animal.
You're calling for legal changes, and we can talk about that in a bit. You're also, I think, asking us to change as individuals how we think about animals. You give a series of emotions you're hoping we talk about, starting with a sense of wonder at our animal neighbors. How can we grasp that and kindle that?
Well, I've worked on emotions for a lot of my career as a philosopher, so it was natural for me to start there. And wonder, I think, is a good starting point, because when we look at animals, we don't just see something cheap and uninteresting. We're inclined to say, wow, isn't that amazing what whales can do, or what elephants can do, or what birds can do. We know so much now about birds. So wonder draws our attention to the creature and makes us see this creature as worthwhile, as an end and not just a means of our own goals. And then when we have wonder, and then we also notice that the creature is suffering because of stuff that we've done, then I think we ought to feel great compassion. But then the compassion is not just, oh, poor elephant, but it's linked to a sense of, isn't it outrageous that this happens? We must change this. So it's kind of not a kind of anger that just beats people over the head with retribution, but a kind that faces forward. I call it transition anger. We turn forward to ask, what can we now do about this outrageous behavior?
We're talking to Martha Nussbaum about her new book, Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. You can join in with your reactions to what she's saying, your thoughts, changes you'd like to see in the way we humans interact with our animal neighbors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Kent is with us in Reedstown. Kent, hi.
Yeah, hi. I believe that veganism is the future of the planet. Conventional animal raising is not sustainable. We can get all the protein we need from vegetables, and industrial agriculture for supporting animals for food is killing us and the planet.
Kent, thanks for the call. Martha, not surprisingly, you talk about the way we raise animals and use them for food. What are your thoughts for Kent?
Well, I think the factory farming industry is a great moral horror. So I totally agree with Kent about that. And it's the first place I would want to start in making change, because it's got a stranglehold over American politics, so that it's very hard to make any other change until you first change that. But I also think that I don't totally agree with veganism in every respect. So let me have a kind of respectful disagreement with Kent. Veganism says, for example, we shouldn't wear things made of wool because that involves shearing sheep. Well, sheep have evolved in such a way that the coat burdens them. They will lead worse sheep lives if their coat is not shorn. So I see nothing wrong with wearing things made from wool. So there are many other places where we could have other examples like that. But I think the main thing should be to treat the animal as an end and to help it lead a flourishing life as the kind of animal it is. But I would certainly agree that stopping the factory farming industry, and how can we do that? Now, they have so much power that they've been able to pass in most states laws that are called ag gag laws, meaning that they put a gag on people who want to be whistleblowers about the terrible conditions in the factory farming industry. And those laws have been repealed in 9 states, but they're still on the books in many other states. So if I wanted to take a video camera and go into the slaughterhouse and photograph what goes on there, I would be breaking the law. So these things first have to be stopped. Then when we can have true reporting about what's really going on, and of course we do have now books that describe the problem, but we need many more documentaries and videos, then the consciousness of everyone will be awakened, and then there will be a movement to end this terrible, terrible industry.
Kent, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Martha, there we could take a couple of approaches to something like that. We could say all or nothing. We completely stop using animals for meat, or we live with what we've got. You see some room in some areas, I don't know about this one, in some areas for incremental improvements that we should be encouraged by. What would you see as some steps in that direction?
Well, I'm what is sometimes pejoratively called a liberal revisionist. That is to say, I do think it's right to make incremental progress. And when you think about the women's movement, something that I've written about a great deal, rather than saying all men are bad and let's separate from them and let's have a radical revolution, I was always in favor of trying to persuade, trying to bring people over and make legal progress gradually. So that's my approach here too. But I think it still is important to stop the worst horrors first. And the factory farming industry is certainly one of the worst horrors. However, it's so powerful in the US, unlike Europe, where actually a lot of reforms have already been introduced. In the US, people who are even candidates for high office have to meet with the American Farm Institute before they could be up for Senate confirmation. And so we have to break the stranglehold of that industry over our political life. And that's very, very difficult. But in the meantime, we can try to tell the truth about that industry, persuade people to change their own individual lives. And gradually, I think the law will catch up.
We're talking to Martha Nussbaum, professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago. Her new book is called Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Your thoughts, your reactions, your questions. Is there a particular animal that you are particularly concerned about that you'd like to see changes made to make their lives better? Call in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest on the philosophy, the ethics, the law surrounding the well-being of animals? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Martha Nussbaum, law and ethics professor at the University of Chicago. We're talking about her new book. It's called Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts or concerns about animal welfare, animal cruelty, how we treat them in agriculture, in the wild, Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions, your own experiences, decisions you've made in your personal life at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Martha, a big part of your argument in the book is that you hope that legal systems around the world can take these ideas of animal thriving, their well-being, and account for them and represent those interests somehow. What could that look like?
Well, it has to have many layers. Right now, animals that are companion animals, animals we live with, are fairly well protected by local and state laws and some national laws, but those laws are not always enforced. So the first thing we need is that animals have to have what's known in the law as standing, that is the right to go to court as the plaintiff of an action. And of course, like humans, they don't go to court themselves. There's a lawyer, and in the case of non-human animals, there would be a guardian who represents the animals and hires the lawyer. But right now, no one can go and challenge the non-enforcement of the laws, because to have standing, you have to have what's known as a particularized injury, and no human qualifies for that, even if you're totally morally outraged by what you see going on. And so there has to be a change in that. And there are four countries in the world, Colombia, Ecuador, and Argentina, and India, where animals, in fact, do have that kind of legal status. And therefore, you can bring a suit in the name of the animal. So that's one very obvious change that I would like to see. But another is just more and better laws. So when we get outside the boundaries of the local, animals are not very well protected. We have some very good national laws, like the Migratory Birds Treaty Act, the Marine Mammals Protection Act, and the Animal Welfare Act. Those are all federal laws, but they leave out the animals we eat. They just didn't want to have that discussion. So the bird treaty says, oh, it's just migratory birds, not the birds we eat, and so forth. Now, those laws are pretty good, but again, they need better enforcement. Now, courts play an active role in this. So I give an example in my book of a very wonderful Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision that interpreted the Marine Mammal Protection Act in a way that recognized the complex form of life that whales live. They saw that the Navy sonar program, while it didn't actually inflict pain on the whales, it did disrupt characteristic activities, migration, and it disrupted their mating activities. It made them migrate with reduced energy. It created heightened stress and so on. So they actually required the Navy to terminate its sonar program. That was a big win for animal protection. But of course, now that's in the coastal areas of the U.S., out in the high seas, so to speak, whales have almost no protection. They're suffering from plastic pollution. They eat plastic and it fills them up, and then they get so full that they die of starvation because they can't eat anything else. The plastic just stays there and it calcifies. They also suffer from noise. Oil drillers are drilling all over the ocean, and they're charting the ocean floor by sending sort of air bombs down to chart the contour of the ocean floor. And these air bombs make huge racket all the time. Whales navigate the world not so much by sight or by smell, but mostly by hearing. So it's created a great deal of stress for all whales. But what do we have? We have a thing called the International Whaling Commission. It was founded, however, to stop harpooning a little bit, to curtail it a little bit, in order to make sure that there are enough whales to be hunted in the future. So it was not a whale protective agency in the least. Over time, it's become somewhat more whale protective, and there's been a moratorium now on all harpooning, but it doesn't do anything about the other things that whales suffer from. And furthermore, nations have to join it voluntarily. Well, that's the problem with all international law, of course. If people don't want to do it, they just don't do it. So Japan, which didn't like the moratorium on whale harpooning, they just quit the International Whaling Commission. And so we really need a much better, more cooperative, and more enforceable international system. And I think the only way we're going to get that is raising public awareness around the world. And so that's one thing I want my book to do. because it's because people don't really know what's going on that they tolerate this. And I think if they really understood the sufferings of whales and dolphins and so on from the lack of law, then they would create a better system of law.
Talking to Martha Nussbaum about her new book. It's called Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. She looks at philosophy and the law and animal well-being. Martha, the suffering you outline in the book, it would be easy to look at the enormity of it you point out and I guess be overwhelmed or discouraged. I think that's pretty clearly not what you're hoping people come out of your book taking. You point towards some signs of hope. Where do you point people toward?
Well, I think there is legal progress. Certainly there's progress in the protection of companion animals, but we also see inroads, as I mentioned before, some of the bad laws that the factory farming industry passed to prevent whistleblowing, those have now been repealed. And so we see progress in that way. As I said, the International Whaling Commission, bad though it is, has become better. It's declared a moratorium on harpooning. But I think the main thing that for people should think about is that every single person can do something. You can talk about animals and try to build a legal movement to protect one particular kind of animal you're interested in. You can, if you're a teacher or a parent, show videos. There's so much good information about animals that you can show in classrooms or to your children just to show what their lives are like and get people interested in that. The Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, which I love, has countless bird calls that you can listen to, and you can learn about the life of each kind of bird and why it's precious. So whatever your position in the world is, there's something that you can do. You can join a local movement. You can join an international movement. And of course, there's the movement to stop poaching, which has deprived many elephants of their lives. So they're just, everyone has something that they can contribute. I think what I can contribute is writing a book, but you know that I'm not an activist and I'm not doing a lot of the great work that activists are doing. So there are just many places that you can contribute. And I hope everyone here will realize that you can learn and that already is progress. And there's something that you can be doing for animals in the world.
Martha, you pointed toward a couple of signs of legal changes. Do you feel as you're talking to people about your book that there is this kind of mindset change in the way we think of the well-being animals in the works?
I do think so. I think, of course, it happens, first of all, in the case of animals that we live with. And I think that has really changed. People think of dogs and cats as beloved members of their family rather than as just tools. I don't like the word pet. I hope it will go out of existence because that word is kind of condescending. It treats the animal like a toy. But I think most people now do not treat their beloved dogs and cats like mere toys. I don't think they always treat them exactly well. I think dogs need a lot more exercise than they often get. They need a lot more close attention and interaction than they sometimes get. But, you know, people's intentions are good and they really do love these creatures. So now the next question is how to educate people about other kinds of animals whose lives are just as rich, just as interesting and complex. And they may be lovable like elephants, or they may not be so very lovable, like coyotes are really interesting animals, and more they live in our cities. So just educating people and getting them not to be afraid of a coyote and not to say, oh, we should shoot it on sight, because coyotes are actually very passive. They don't attack other animals or children, but they can be kept under control in our cities without killing them. So people need to just educate themselves and learn where the risks are to animal life and what they want to do about it. And I do see many, many signs of that happening. My daughter worked for this NGO that worked on wild animals, not so much domestic animals. And the wild animals, you know, there are lots of wild animals in the United States. She was particularly interested in whales, but that was really not in her office work. Her office work was concerned with creatures like the American bison, the wild horses, who are increasingly, there's a war between the cattle ranchers in Wyoming and the wild horses.
So we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Martha Nussbaum. Her new book is called Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.